All right, our second case this morning is number 19-10479, Derek Wynn versus the City of Griffin, Georgia, et al. Mr. Howard.
May it please the court, I'm James W. Howard, representing Derek Wynn, the plaintiff and the appellant in a 1983 civil rights action. Mr. Wynn was a hospital security officer who was maliciously prosecuted for using minimal force to restrain a hostile, aggressive, and intoxicated patient. The district court granted a summary judgment to the defendants despite accurate findings of fact that virtually established the defendant's misconduct and liability. This appeal addresses four interrelated issues that I've tried to separate so that they make a little more sense, but they do tend to overlap both in terms of the underlying facts and the law. First issue being roughly that the issue of the scope of qualified immunity for a rookie police officer with no investigative training or experience who fabricated evidence to prosecute a serious felony offense with no arguable probable cause for that criminal prosecution. Second issue is the scope of qualified immunity for that same police officer who deliberately ignored readily available evidence to fabricate probable cause for the criminal prosecution. The third issue is the scope of sovereign immunity for a police department that permitted, facilitated, and even promoted this absurdly flawed investigation. And finally, the scope of a district court's discretion to exclude the opinions of a qualified expert witness on police practices. The appellant essentially agrees with the district court's analysis of the evidence. District court correctly found that the police officer obtained an arrest warrant to prosecute the case based on false information and without arguable probable cause. However, the district court still erred in deciding that the defendants were entitled to summary judgment based on qualified immunity. The two primary precedents that I'm relying upon, of course, we've cited multiple precedents in the appellate briefs, but the two overriding precedents are Franks versus Delaware at 438 U.S. 154 and Kingsland versus City of Miami at 382 F. 3rd 1220, a case decided by this court in 2004.
Mr. Howard, can I ask you a question? This is Judge Jordan.
Yes, sir.
Those Franks versus Delaware comes from the criminal context and when someone can challenge information that's been obtained through the submission of a false affidavit by a law enforcement official. And that case aligns with your argument and the district court's ruling that there was no probable cause or arguable probable cause for the aggravated battery charge. But how does that case get to the issue of whether or not there was probable cause or arguable probable cause for a simple battery arrest?
Well, that is obviously going to be part of my argument, and I can go right there in response to your question. There is a misunderstanding, I think, by the district court an understandable misunderstanding as to what that means. There is case law that supports the premise that if a police officer arrests someone for a criminal offense and it turns out that they only have probable cause for a different criminal offense, then they are still protected by the shield of qualified immunity. They can't be expected to necessarily get that right. But that's not the situation that we have here. What we have in a situation here is where an officer undergoes an investigation of a very serious charge, an aggravated battery charge, a felony with a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison, and having gone through that investigation, does not have arguable probable cause based upon the evidence and the court's ruling, doesn't have arguable probable cause to support that prosecution, and doesn't pursue any other prosecution. But post hoc, the opposing party rationalizes that, and the district court accepted the rationalization that, well, perhaps there was arguable probable cause for a misdemeanor offense, and that can therefore shield the officer with qualified immunity. there's a wealth of legal authority on that very issue. And I start, I'm not sure where it is on the brief, but when an officer, and I'm quoting from Holmes v. Village of Hoffman Estates, a Seventh Circuit case, when an officer prepares and signs a criminal complaint, he typically will have more of an opportunity to reflect on the nature and ramifications of the accused conduct than he did in making the arrest. It is reasonable to demand that each charge that a police officer elects to lodge against the accused be supported by probable cause. Otherwise, police officers would be free to tack a variety of baseless charges onto one valid charge with no risk of being held accountable for their excess.
Can I interrupt
perhaps
you?
A better language.
Mr. Howard, let me interrupt you again.
Yes.
Does that go to your argument about the lack of investigation based on Kingsland, or are you making a separate argument that the concept of arguable probable cause cannot extend to lesser included offenses?
It cannot exclude to lesser. Yeah, I do want the court to distinguish between a situation where an officer is making an arrest and a situation where an officer is conducting an investigation. There's a case that has language directly on point out of the Second Circuit. Otherwise, officers could add unsupported serious charges to legitimate minor charges with impunity. Even if you have, and I'll say arguable probable cause because that's the most that they have, that a simple battery was committed, that is a very minor charge. And to tack onto that a very serious felony offense of aggravated battery is not justified, and we'll support a 1983 civil claim.
This very, very minor offense would not establish
arguable probable cause for the felony offense. And there's ample authority in my brief on that point.
Mr. Howard, hold on. Judge Anderson wants to ask you a question.
Sure. Your Honor.
The problem, we realize that there is law in other circuits, the Seventh Circuit and the Second Circuit, supporting your position. But even if we adopted that law, it wouldn't be clearly established, and it wouldn't help you in this case, because our law is fairly clear that if there is probable cause or even arguable probable cause for any offense, then 1983 Fourth Amendment claim is defeated. We've said that in several cases.
I have three responses to that. First is that there is authority in this circuit that supports my position, and I think very clearly supports my position. And I'll cite the court to Elmore versus Fulton County School District at 605 Federal Appendix, 906, and to UBO versus Reno, UBOH, versus Reno at 141 F3rd 1000. What we're talking about here is not only a logical, and there's a very recent case, in fact, came out this year in Florida, Rhodes v. Robbins, 2019 Westlaw 1160828. All of this clearly establishes this principle that you can't justify a felony prosecution based upon a misdemeanor offense. They're just so graphically different. The second issue, of course, is that there is a jury issue. Even if you could find arguable probable cause in this case, it would be a jury issue because there is ample evidence before that would be presented to a jury that there was no arguable probable cause even for a misdemeanor prosecution in this
case. Counsel, you have 2 minute warning.
I'm sorry?
Counsel, 2 minute warning.
Oh, thank you.
Judge Toflat.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the constitutional violation here?
They went
to the magistrate violation. Got an arrest warrant, but he was never taken into custody. He walked down to the police station and bailed himself out, but was never in custody. So which constitutional provision was violated in this case?
He did have to turn himself in. He was in custody. He was prosecuted as a result.
No. The complaint doesn't say he was taken into custody. It says he went downtown and bailed himself out.
He turned himself in and was detained until he was booked and released.
Is your contention that when he went downtown, he was seized?
You have
to have a seizure.
Yes, that is correct.
He was seized.
I do want to emphasize the point that
Is your argument that the issuance of an arrest warrant constitutes a seizure?
The issuance of the warrant itself does not constitute the seizure.
When does a seizure occur?
The seizure occurs when he is seized. He is seized when he is either arrested or turns himself in on the warrant.
Well, he was not arrested. He was not taken into custody. So when did the seizure occur?
And with all due respect, Your Honor, I believe that the court is mistaken on that. It would be my position.
I'm looking at your complaint.
Well, I don't have the complaint in front of me, but I know what happened.
The complaint doesn't say anything like that.
I would be surprised if it doesn't, because he obviously turned himself in and was detained.
Paragraph 29 of the complaint: on October 29, plaintiff voluntarily turned himself in at the Spalding County Sheriff's Office and posted bail.
Right. And when?
Was that a seizure?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. The major point that I wanted to make
So the officer is responsible for the seizure.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The major point I wanted to make in response to the prior question is that there was no misdemeanor prosecution ever contemplated by anybody. This is a post hoc rationalization. At the time, the case was only prosecuted for aggravated battery. When the district attorney's office got it and analyzed it, they decided that no crime had been committed whatsoever, and based upon that, they dismissed the case entirely as opposed to even contemplating some kind of misdemeanor prosecution. I submit to the court that there is no arguable probable cause for even a misdemeanor prosecution, and if there arguably was, it would certainly be a jury issue. I think one of the flaws in the opposing argument is that they take the position that the officer does not have to consider defenses to the misdemeanor prosecution. That if they can somehow rationalize that a misdemeanor could have been prosecuted if they had thought about it, then that is sufficient to avoid create the shield of qualified immunity. I think the example that I put in the brief is somewhat absurd but very accurate under the circumstances. I gave an example of elderly woman.
Your time has run. If you want to keep your full time for rebuttal, you can stop now or you can eat into that time. Your choice.
I will save it for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Couch. Ms. Couch? Ms. Couch, are you on the line? Valerie, can you check and see if we've lost Ms. Couch?
Ms. Couch?
Judge Jordan, this is Tom Barrera. For some reason, I'm unmuting her, and it's showing she's unmuted, but let me work on that. Give me 2 seconds, please.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
She's Navy whistleblower. Emory University graduate. 1996, double degree. Summa cum laude, undergraduate, and double degree, 1996.
Good morning. Hello.
Good morning, Ms. Couch.
Hi there. I'm sorry, it appears that there had been some sort of technical issue. I heard the entire argument and I could hear everyone, but I guess you guys couldn't hear me. I'm very sorry about that.
That's okay. You can start whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you. May it please the court. Again, Angela Couch on behalf of the Appalachians, City of Griffin, Chief Heaton, and Tina Bean. One of the things I want to make sure that the court understands is we've heard a lot about Officer Bean being a rookie. I think what's important to know is that this was a team effort. This wasn't a case where she was given the case file and thrown out the door and said good luck. She asked for permission, which was granted, and she worked side by side with a senior investigator. They spent a month on the case. They watched the incident video for many, many hours. They brought in a lieutenant, and together it was a group decision that there was, in fact, probable cause for aggravated battery.
I don't know if that cuts for you or against you.
Well, I think it cuts for me in that it shows that there was more than one officer who was taking a look at the facts, and it would be hard to say then that no reasonable officer could find that there was probable cause. I mean, they spent a lot of time on this case, and together decided that it was in fact sufficient for aggravated battery.
What did they think the injury was that warranted an aggravated battery charge?
So when Mr. Shaw, the patient, came in for his interview, he tells them, and if you watch, it's a videotaped interview, if you watch it, he explains to them what happened physically as well as describing it. And he tells them that he had a shoulder injury before. It was, quote, healing up nicely, but after Mr. Wynn came down on him with so much force, he was going to have to go back to his bone doctor and get it reset. In fact, 2 days after the incident, he went back to the hospital. He brought the discharge papers with him and showed them to Officer Bean. So the argument there about there being an injury is from the victim himself, and he, in fact, had the papers to say that he'd gone back to the hospital to have it looked at and was going to make an appointment with his bone doctor on the Friday following the videotaped interview.
Right. Now, the thing is that the aggravated battery statute doesn't just talk about injury. It says that you have to deprive a person of a member of his or her body by rendering a member of his or her body useless, or by seriously disfiguring his or her body as a member thereof. Which subsection do you think this fell under?
So in the affidavit, it's charged as the seriously disfiguring. And the aggravated battery statute does not, in fact, define what seriously disfigured means. The case law, they've looked at, the appellate courts have looked at Black's Law Dictionary, and they've determined that, in fact, it means an injury, an impairment. It means something that it doesn't work right, so to speak. The injury does not have to be visible. It doesn't have to be permanent. It just has to be something more than a superficial wound. In fact, at trial, the state does not have to present medical testimony about the severity of the injury. The testimony of the victim, him or herself, is sufficient. Some examples where an aggravated battery conviction has been upheld is a case where there was a severe knee sprain and the victim said he suffered pain. There's a case where there was a child that had a pre-existing, about a month-old, broken collarbone, and then he suffered a broken arm, both by the same person. There was a case with a head injury that required stitches, and it resulted in scarring. And finally, there's another case where there was just deep bruising that resulted in some scar tissue. The Georgia appellate courts have said all of those rise to the level of an aggravated battery. In this case, you've got the victim showing and telling the officer, you know, I was fine, and now I'm not fine. Yeah, he had an injury before, but Georgia law doesn't say that just because there's a pre-existing injury, that if the defendant proximately causes an aggravation of that injury, then it can't be aggravated battery. That's not the law in Georgia. And so to say that that there was, in fact, no arguable probable cause for aggravated battery, the district court got it wrong. In fact, there was arguable probable cause for aggravated battery. And I think if for some reason you want to say, okay, well, it didn't rise to the level of a seriously disfiguring, how is Officer Bean supposed to know that? Because it's not defined in the statute. And the case law regarding what injury is sufficient is clear that only a jury can really decide that. But given the cases that I just talked about, that's sufficient to be an aggravated battery. So she didn't fabricate anything. When you read the affidavit, which is it's Exhibit 7 in her deposition, which has been submitted to the court, she explains that it's a serious disfigurement when Derek Wynn threw Mr. Shaw on the bed while using force with his forearm on the victim's throat, resulting in an injury to his collarbone. When you watch the incident video, which is a hospital security camera, that's exactly what happened. So there's no falsification. There's no fabrication here. Officer Bean did everything that she could be expected to do in terms of working with her supervisors, went to the ADA, and then got the warrant signed off by the magistrate. Now, the argument about whether there could be arguable probable cause for a lesser offense, there is plenty of case law.
Before you get to that, Judge Anderson,
yes, sir,
question, what is the evidence with respect to what Shaw said about Wynn motivated to harm him because Wynn thought he was a sex offender?
Yes, sir. So Shaw gave three statements. He gave a statement the night of the incident. He gave a statement days later where he just met with Officer Bean at the hospital and said he wanted to go ahead and report the crime. And then you also have the videotaped interview of Shaw. In all three times, he says that Wynn said something to him about being a child molester or a sex offender. There's also an audio taped interview of the other security officer who was in the room at the time Mr. Wynn attacked Mr. Shaw. And in that audio recorded interview, he also says that Shaw says that Mr. Wynn was saying something to him about being a child molester. Now, the security officer says, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what Mr. Shaw kept saying. So he was consistent in his statement that Mr. Wynn was upset with him and didn't like the fact that he was a child molester or a sex offender. So I want to turn now to the idea of an arguable probable cause for a lesser included offense. In Georgia, you have three levels of battery. You have a simple battery, a battery, and an aggravated battery. And the idea that in this circuit, the law is clear that in a malicious prosecution case, if in fact there's probable cause for any crime, then the malicious prosecution claim fails. And the law is clear. And if in fact, as your honors have mentioned, if in fact you want to change that law, Officer Bean it wouldn't be clearly established to her if suddenly we're going to take these cases and say, well, they don't really apply to you. There are multiple cases where that's been held by this as late as November of last year.
This is Judge Anderson with another question. Your opponent says that several cases, and he cites Elmo, which of course is unpublished, and I'm not sure about Rose v. Robbins. He gave a Westlaw site. Is that published or not? Do you know?
No, sir. I don't know. But if in fact,
what about Ubo, UBOH, which cites, and it is a published opinion. He cites it for the proposition that supporting his position that you cannot a misdemeanor arguable probable cause for a misdemeanor cannot entitle a person to qualified immunity for a felony charge.
Well, I'm not sure that that's exactly what the Ubo case says, first of all. Second of all, even assuming that it does, when you've got the 11th Circuit within qualified immunity cases telling an officer that as long as you have probable cause for any crime, then you will be cloaked with the privilege of qualified immunity. And then you have this outlier case, this Ubo case. If, in fact, you've got those two cases, it can't possibly be held that it's then clearly established for the purposes of denying qualified immunity when you've got two cases that are on either side of this issue.
So
it
you also do not know what Ubo holds.
I think what Ubo holds is that if, in fact, you were arrested for one charge, you're tried on a couple of other charges, and the charge that you were arrested on, ultimately you were found not guilty on, then the officer who arrested you may not be entitled to qualified immunity. That's my understanding of what Ubo says. But I don't think what Ubo holds is that I think the misdemeanor felony distinction is not clear in the law when you have these other cases that talk about any crime, as long as there's probable or arguable probable cause for any crime. There's certainly no clear message to be sent to the officers that you've got to make a decision at the probable cause level of whether this is going to be a misdemeanor or a felony. And if you don't get it right at the probable cause level, then you're opening yourself up to 1983 actions. That's not the law in the circuit currently. The officers don't go through that when they're writing out the affidavits to get a search warrant. They're not going through. They're trying to figure out, do I in fact have probable cause for the crime that I think has been committed? This weighing of whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, that's not what's going on because that's not what the law currently requires. If there's a disagreement on this issue, then it's unfair to subject the police officer to potential money damages because he or she may land on the wrong side of the controversy. And for that, I would cite Gates versus Coke Bar, which is 884 F3rd 1290. That's an 11th Circuit case, 2018. The fact that it ultimately didn't result in a misdemeanor prosecution is irrelevant. What happens after the fact has no bearing on the probable cause analysis. The other thing I want to make sure that I cover before I run out of time, we moved for summary judgment on qualified immunity, but also on the lack of evidence for the claims. If and for some reason the court were determined that there was no qualified immunity in this case, there's still very much a lack of evidence regarding malice. This is a malicious prosecution case, and in fact, there's no evidence of malice in this case. And the district court didn't reach that issue, having found qualified immunity, but we did move for it below, and I just want to make sure that I put that out there, so to speak. But I think qualified immunity cloaks Officer Bean in this case because she had arguable probable cause for aggravated battery under those cases that I have cited. She has arguable probable cause for simple battery. Watching the video, there's no doubt that there was a harmful touching of Mr. Shaw by Mr. Wynn. She didn't fabricate any evidence. The law in this circuit requires perjury to strip her of her qualified immunity. You have to show, the plaintiff has to show that she perjured herself or that she recklessly omitted important facts. When you read the affidavit in this case, she says exactly what happened. Whether the injury rises to the level of a serious disfigurement is up for grabs.
Counsel, 2 minute warning.
Thank you. Mr. Howard did not really discuss the issue about the city's motion for the summary judgment or on the Daubert issue. If the panel has any questions regarding either of those matters, I stand ready to answer those questions. otherwise, you know, the district court got it right in terms of granting qualified immunity. I think the district court got it wrong that there was not arguable probable cause for aggravated battery. There was. But even if you find that there was not, there's arguable probable cause for the lesser included offenses, or if, in fact, you're going to decide that you can't go that route, it's not clearly established. So the qualified immunity should remain, and the district court's order granting summary judgment to the appellee should be affirmed.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, am I back?
Yes, you are.
Yes. I'll try to speak quickly to touch the points I really need to touch on. I want to start by emphasizing that the appellant is by no means conceding that there's any probable cause for a misdemeanor prosecution. There was certainly no misdemeanor prosecution contemplated at the time. The district attorney's office took a look at the case and didn't think about a misdemeanor prosecution. The opposing side didn't think about a prosecution until they were briefing this issue, and they came up with that as a possibility. So there was never any contemplation of prosecuting a simple battery, and the facts simply did not support it. By the district court's analysis, there would be probable cause to prosecute any security officer for simple battery after he uses minimal reasonable force to restrain someone. And by the district court's analysis, the justification for the restraint could be ignored, just characterize it as an affirmative defense. That's not a distinction that is made in the law. The investigating officer must consider the circumstances, must consider whether the officer is clearly defending himself, must consider if he's using minimal force, and we not only have that quite visible on the surveillance tape, we even have an expert opinion corroborating that he obviously used minimal force to restrain a very difficult patient. The other point I want to make...
Hold on, Mr. Howard. But the concept of probable cause is not the same as proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and you're suggesting that a police officer has to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the accused to determine whether or not there's probable cause to charge?
No, what I'm suggesting is that the officer has to conduct a legitimate investigation, and that's what the case law supports, and all of the evidence, and I do mean all of the evidence, supports the finding that there was no simple battery, that there was simply a minimal use of restraint on an intoxicated, difficult, aggressive patient. That's what all of the evidence supports. She didn't talk to anybody at the hospital. The statements from the other person in the room, the other security officer in the room, were available to her. She decided not to listen to one and not to look at the other. Instead, she was hell-bent on prosecuting this case because this was her opportunity to be an investigator. She'd never investigated anything before, which kind of brings me to my point on the collaboration of the other parties, which the other people involved in this, which the opposing party uses as a defense. But Officer Bean, Lieutenant Richardson, Sergeant Hancock, they didn't collectively review the evidence before they decided to prosecute Mr. Nguyen. They basically ratified Officer Bean's inadequate investigation, gave her no supervision, gave her no training, just let her experiment with this investigation because she wanted some experience being an investigator. And as a result of that, that's one of the bases for the city's liability. There was no training at all, minimal supervision. They just let Officer Bean do what she wanted to do, and that's what the evidence supports in this case.
What did Mr. Nguyen say about how this incident took place?
Mr. Nguyen's account of this is entirely consistent with everything that I have told you. He said that he used minimal force, that this was a difficult patient who came at him, who touched him first. He had to do something, and so all he did was put his weight on him until he stopped, and then he got up. Didn't hurt him at all, and I do want to emphasize this. What you have just heard about Mr. Shaw re-injuring or being injured, that is not true. That is not in the evidence. There are no medical records that show that Mr. Shaw had any subsequent medical treatment as a result of this. There is no statement by Mr. Shaw that this incident in any way exacerbated his injury. This is something that the appellees want to make out of the evidence, but does not exist in the evidence.
Judge Anderson, this is Judge Anderson with a question. Are you suggesting to me and to us that when we look at, for example, the deposition of or the statement that audio recording of Dawkins, the other security guard, and Beans, Officer Beans' deposition, that we will not see that Shaw did tell them, and Dawkins did tell them that his shoulder injury was aggravated?
I can certainly say it's not in Dawkins' testimony.
That is not in Dawkins'.
And as for Officer Beam, I certainly do not recall it. I have reviewed in great detail the statement of Mr. Shaw, the recorded statement, and he says nothing that could remotely be construed like that. And frankly, I don't remember Officer Beam saying anything like that. If she said something like that, it must have been some private conversation that wasn't recorded, because everything that's on both videos, both at the hospital and in the subsequent interview of Mr. Shaw, he never says anything that I think could be reasonably construed as an exacerbation of that injury. He acknowledged
he had an injury,
and that's it.
There was an interview of Shaw by Bean that you were not privy to. That was immediately after, when that's one time that
your opponent, met with him privately?
Yes. And then the video itself shows him rubbing the shoulder, does it not?
Yes, it does. And I don't doubt that his shoulder was sore before he got there. That was a recent injury. He occurred in a bike accident, and so he had a shoulder. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you that it's impossible that Mr. Wynn putting some weight on this person's shoulder to restrain him couldn't have made his shoulder sore. But I'm highly confident that even in the statement between Mr. Shaw and Officer Bean a few days after, there's nothing that could be construed as evidence that there was an exacerbation of the shoulder injury. That's what realistically happened here, Your Honor, is that Officer Bean found out about the shoulder injury, that he had an injured clavicle, got excited, thought that she could pursue an aggravated battery based upon that because she was there and she was a part of it, and thought she had a case, and then discovered that he already had that injury and decided to pursue the claim anyway. And unfortunately, the evidence doesn't support it, but she had already decided, being an inexperienced investigator, having no training, having no supervision, she just decided she was going to make a felony case and never came up with any evidence to support the notion that this was an aggravation of a pre-existing injury. It's something she made up, and that's why when she applied for the warrant, she didn't mention it. She didn't mention the previous injury. She acted like this whole injury was caused by Mr. Wynn when he put his weight on him, knowing full well that that was not true. And that's how realistically this happened. She had just decided, this is my opportunity. They are, for some reason, giving me this opportunity to be an investigator. Let me take advantage of it and prosecute this aggravated battery charge. Oops, the evidence doesn't support it. Well, that's all right. They're going to let me do it anyway. I'm going to do it anyway. And as soon as a serious prosecutor looked at the facts of the case and the evidence in the case, they threw it out because it had no merit whatsoever. I submit that you will not find any evidence in this record that Mr. Shaw claimed that this is an aggravation of a pre-existing injury or that she realistically believed this was an aggravation of a pre-existing injury. She was pretending that the injury to the clavicle occurred in the altercation at the hospital, knowing that that was not true, and her superiors let her do it. They let her do it by not supervising her, and they let her do it by not training her, just letting her be an investigator, get a little practice. That's realistic.
All right, Mr. Howard. Thank you very much. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.